Negotiations will resume on the contentious Flathead Water Compact. Good evening, I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Flathead reporter Katrin Fry takes us to a workshop on backcountry horse packing, and in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with a Rocky Mountain Lab scientist about the dangers of hantavirus. Governor Steve Bullock plans to reopen limited negotiations for a water rights compact with the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes. State officials said today they need to revisit a water use agreement between the tribes and irrigation districts in western Montana. It would be incorporated into the larger compact and be presented to the 2015 legislature. Tribal leaders have agreed to reopen negotiations solely for that purpose. The water use agreement was an appendix to the water rights compact, which the 2013 legislature rejected. The group that negotiated the water use agreement on behalf of three irrigation districts then disbanded, effectively invalidating it. The talks will take place this summer. Four lawsuits seek to resolve the dispute over who controls the water and how much goes to farmers, ranchers, and others through the Flathead Indian Irrigation Project.
And in other news from around the state, a new lawsuit has been filed over Governor Steve Bullock's nomination of 5.1 million acres of U.S. Forest Service land for priority management. The complaint filed last week by Wild West Institute, Conservation Congress, and Friends of the Bitterroot is the second since Bullock forwarded his choices for expedited restoration and management to Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack in April. The Independent Record reports the groups allege the state violated open meetings laws and the right to public participation when a committee advised the governor on which forest lands to choose. The groups say no notice was given of the committee's meetings and no minutes were recorded. The lawsuit asks a state judge to void the nominations. Administration officials declined comment. Steve Kelly of Bozeman filed a similar lawsuit last month.
Bozeman city leaders have given their initial backing to a measure creating protections for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people. The city commission voted 4-0 yesterday for an ordinance that would outlaw discrimination in the workplace, housing, and public accommodations on the basis of sexual orientation of gender identity. The proposal must pass a final vote scheduled for June 2nd before it takes effect. Commissioner Chris Mell says he is convinced that discrimination against gays and lesbians exists in Bozeman and that there is a need for the measure. Before the vote, 55 people spoke in the two-hour meeting. Commissioners exempted religious schools and corporations from the hiring requirements. They also exempted goods or facilities provided for a service that is primarily religious in nature from the public accommodations requirements.
Five couples have sued to overturn the nation's first constitutional ban on same-sex marriage. Yesterday, the couple sued the state of Alaska, which passed the ban in 1998. The plaintiffs are alleging in federal court that the ban is unconstitutional. The Human Rights Campaign says there are only three other states, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Montana, that don't have legal challenges pending to same-sex marriage bans. Over the years, the Alaska Supreme Court has chipped away at laws deemed discriminatory against gay couples, but it wasn't until now, after major U.S. Supreme Court decisions that led to federal courts around the country striking down bans on same-sex marriage as unconstitutional, that some activists felt the time was right to challenge Alaska's ban on gay marriage.
Breaking down barriers keeping women from hunting, fishing, boating, mountain biking, or any other list of outdoor activities is the goal behind Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Becoming an Outdoors Woman program. The program operates in more than 40 states and Canada and has been going on in Montana for 20 years. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry takes us to one of its workshops on backcountry horse packing.
We have learned about the different saddles, the different kinds of pack saddles, the sawbucks and the deckers and panniers. And we've talked about bear-resistant boxes versus non-bear-resistant boxes and what you can take into the bob. And
Judy Breland goes over some of the lessons they've been learning in the horse packing workshop. She's gone horse packing before. In fact, her husband Andy Breland is teaching the class, and the family has a store, Trailhead Supply, that sells horse packing equipment.
I'm slowly learning. He's the one that's done the packing, and I haven't really had too much interest in the horses, but I'm starting to get more interest in them. So I figured I better learn. And I also have had to fill in at the store when he's gone. And I'm like, people come in and I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about. So I figured I better start learning a little more if I'm going to be able to help there.
Andy Breland says he's been leading this workshop for several years. He contracts as a packer with the Forest Service, Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, and for private interests. But when this workshop breaks up into small groups for the hands-on learning, one of the other packers will be working with Judy.
Because all good arguments start at the tailgate, and it's really hard to teach your wife, and that's why a lot of these women are here. They either had a significant other that they used to pack with that never let them help, and they have that interest in the backcountry, let it be a significant other or dad, and they would like to continue on, but no one ever let them practice it, so they just need that confidence. Or the husband, it's just faster if I do it all, which is the case in my household.
Judy Breland says she's gone backpacking in the backcountry and knows a lot of the safety skills and bear-aware details. But it's time to learn about horsepacking.
I need to know how to put on a tie, the knots to get the pack saddle to stay there, because I'd like to go on maybe possibly the women's packing trip with my daughter. And that, so he won't be along to help me do everything. So I need to know how to get the pack up on the saddle and to tie it in so it stays.
Many of the women at this Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Becoming an Outdoors Woman workshop, like Breland, have some knowledge of horses, of backpacking, of the backcountry, but they don't have the detailed knowledge about the hows of leading a pack string of horses into the wilderness. Andy Breland says there's really one thing they're lacking.
And really, if you can take it down to like in a nutshell, is confidence. I think that most people here today have stock. They know how to ride a horse. They have that dream of going into the Bob Marshall Wilderness. They just need someone to hold their hand and kind of reassure what they already know they know and go enjoy life.
This is one of the underlying goals of all the Becoming an Outdoors Woman or BOW classes. State Coordinator of BOW, Liz Laudman, says FWP has been offering various classes for 20 years.
If there's something that's inhibiting a woman from getting out and enjoying the outdoors, we want her to learn the skills and have the knowledge to feel comfortable doing that. What we're really trying to provide is the first step in learning whatever the topic is. For this one, it was horse packing. And then where to go to next, you know, and it might be for these ladies to join a backcountry horseman group.
The BOW program itself started out of the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point, in 1991.
They were looking at why more women don't hunt and fish, and what are the barriers to women participating in outdoor activities. So really, the BOW workshop was designed to help encourage women to get outdoors and to break down those barriers.
Today, Laudman says the BOW workshops range from horsepacking to firearm shooting to mountain biking. Those are the one-day skill-specific workshops. FWP also offers a three-day event every summer with courses including angling, canoeing, and more. Laudman says the biggest classes are outdoor survival and using a map and compass.
So I think women have a fear of getting lost or getting in trouble outdoors, and how are they going to help themselves? So they really like to sign up for those two particular classes just so they know that they could survive a night outdoors in the woods unexpectedly.
Laudman says all the courses are geared toward those already with knowledge as well as beginners.
From a college student to a newly married lady who's has a husband who does outdoor stuff and he wants her to come and join her to do those activities. We have moms come. They want to learn things that they can bring back and share with their children. Newly retired people, empty nesters who have more time on their hands.
At the horse packing class, the women fit this description. Older, younger, more experienced with horses, and less. The teachers have been showing tips and tricks for how to wrap up and pack gear, how to balance the load on the horse, how to know by looking at the horse if the gear is balanced, and ways to successfully pick up heavy boxes to pack on the horses. Vara Deviam of Ronan says she went packing with an outfitter last year and got hooked.
Yeah, it was fabulous. It was so great.
Have you been backpacking before?
You know, I can't carry a backpack because of my neck. So this is a way of getting out in the woods. I'm 58 and, you know, it's a way to get out there at my age.
And have a good dinner at the end of the day.
Yeah, exactly. And a soft chair.
Andy Breland did give a disclaimer during the class. Horse packing is addictive. With each of the BOW classes, FWP hopes to spark some other outdoors addictions in women from all walks of life. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
The head of the Montana Mining Association is suggesting members punish a Bozeman outfitter for an article about a mining development planned by a company for which she lobbies. The Independent Record reports interim executive director Tammy Johnson wrote in a May 2nd memo that a Field and Stream article makes outlandish claims about the proposed copper mine near White Sulphur Springs. The article's author is former Yellow Dog Fly Fishing Adventures employee Sarah Grigg. She quotes Trout Unlimited's conservation director as saying the Tintina Resources Project would be a big deal for recreationists and agriculture if it dewaters the Smith River. Johnson writes MMA members should consider outfitters other than Yellow Dog in response to the article. Johnson says the memo is not reflective of her role as a lobbyist for Tintina.
Western icons are the focus of an exhibition opening this Friday at the Dana Gallery in Missoula. It's the third annual Icons of the West exhibit. Gallery owner Dudley Dana says he wanted a theme that would attract artists from around the country.
I saw a painting in another gallery that was called Western Icon, and it was a painting of a bison. And I immediately thought two things. First of all, that would be a great theme for a show. And second of all, there are lots of icons, everything from a bison to a grizzly to an outhouse to an oil well.
Over 100 pieces were accepted out of 500 submitted from around the country in different mediums. Dana says they invited submissions from art school students as well.
Our growing mission in the gallery has been to represent not only nationally recognized artists, but also to give young artists a start, you know, a place to show, a chance to be seen when they might not get seen, to get some kind of exposure.
Awards will be given in categories ranging from Best Traditional Western Painting to Best Critter. The exhibit opens Friday evening, May 16th from 6 to 8 p.m. and runs till the 1st of July at the Dana Gallery.
Hantavirus season is here, and health officials are warning people to take precautions to guard against the virus that can lead to fatigue, aches, and eventually progress to coughing, shortness of breath, and in some cases, death. National Institutes of Health researchers have developed an important animal model of human hantavirus pulmonary syndrome that may one day lead to treatments, vaccines, and improved diagnosis methods. The study was conducted by researchers at NIH's National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases and published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Edward O'Brien has more with Rocky Mountain Laboratory's staff scientist and lead study author, Dave Sofronitz.
Early on in my career as an undergraduate, there was the outbreak in the Four Corners region in 1993, and I really got interested in hantaviruses at that point. To have pathogens like that circulating within North America, it really seemed something that was interesting and something that I wanted to focus my research on. So during my PhD studies at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg, I focused on field investigations, going out and trapping mice, looking at prevalence rates and transmission, and also moved into some of the biocontainment aspects of research, looking at vaccine platforms that might be effective at preventing disease.
Are we talking specifically about a deer mice here, or can any ordinary mouse carry this?
The predominant hantavirus in North America is called Cinombre virus, and that's maintained within deer mice. There are other variants of Hanta circulating in North America and far more in South America, and in fact worldwide. They each seem to be associated with a unique rodent reservoir.
I know probably most, at least many Montanans are familiar with hantavirus, but for those who are not, in English that I and, you know, most lay people can understand, what is it? How does it work?
So it's a rodent-borne virus that is spread, in the case of Cinombre, from deer mice. And so people become infected when they're exposed to contaminated urine or saliva from these mice. And so the mice might contaminate a food source. People may aerosolize it when they're cleaning outlying buildings, for example. And then they breathe it in. And it seems to lay fairly dormant in the body for quite some time. It can have an incubation period of up to 18 or even 21 days, and sometimes longer. And at that point, people develop a rather severe respiratory distress syndrome that requires medical attention and quite frequently mechanical ventilation. So they're put on the machines to help them breathe.
And that's hantavirus pulmonary syndrome?
That's correct, hantavirus pulmonary syndrome.
And again, Synomre virus is the active ingredient there.
Yeah, it's the predominant virus circulating in North America. So it's found all over Canada and virtually everywhere as well in the United States.
Does it affect everyone equally? I mean, can some people snort a bucket of dried mouse droppings and not be any worse for the wear, or are others more susceptible?
It's commonly believed that everybody who is exposed or infected with the virus will develop some sort of a disease. It can have varying severities. For example, children quite often have a much milder syndrome. In adults, though, yeah, people generally will show the characteristic signs of infection, which is, again, the respiratory distress. Some people certainly have a milder course, but in general, they will all seek, it will be severe enough that they'll all need medical attention.
Okay, so I'm told that developing a vaccine or a treatment for any given disease, you start in a lab with test tubes, you keep working there until you can work out a small animal model. And in this hantavirus Synomre study, that point was reached about 10 years ago. Is that right?
So for Synomre, actually, there isn't a small animal model. There is a hamster model of HPS that's based on infecting a Syrian hamster with a strain called Andes virus. It's basically the most prominent or prevalent hantavirus circulating in South America.
Why aren't there more studies with the small animals?
We've done numerous studies here at RML with the hamster. We utilize that quite frequently in our research. We've done several vaccine studies. We're looking at therapeutic approaches and just general studies focusing on pathogenesis, trying to figure out exactly what the virus is doing in these animal models in order to identify targets to potentially treat the disease.
So then the next step in this research is going up to a larger animal study, ferrets and monkeys, right?
Correct, yeah. Typically, when you're dealing with the disease, it's believed to at least be partially mediated by your host immune response. Larger animals tend to respond much more similarly to humans than do small animals. So for this line of research, a non-human primate model is preferred and has been the focus of the field for around 20 years now. And we think the key to the success of our study was how the virus was prepared. So what we did was exposed monkeys to a virus that had only been passaged through deer mice. So rather than artificially propagating the virus in the lab setting, we maintain a colony of deer mice here at RML, and we're able to keep the virus in those mice. There was evidence previously with other viruses, similar viruses, that the way that we propagate them in the lab somehow weakens the virus. And so that's what we based our studies on. What we'd like to focus on next is utilizing the model for diagnostic approaches. So the problem with HPS in general is the cases are generally few and far between. They occur rather sporadically. And so it's difficult to get good clinical samples, especially early in the syndrome, from humans that we can use to evaluate potential targets for a diagnostic approach. So in order to identify the disease earlier, we need samples from earlier in the disease that we can analyze. That's going to be one of the key uses of this model for us. And then we'd also like to extend it into therapeutic studies, trying to figure out a way that we can treat or prevent this disease from occurring in humans.
This is the rub. I mean, this is a very difficult nut to crack, it sounds like.
It's certainly not going to be easy. I think we're a long ways away, but the development of the model, I think, is a good step forward. I think it's going to be hopefully well received in the field and established at multiple different lab and medical research facilities. And so working together, hopefully we can figure something out.
We've kind of glossed over this monkey model. That's a huge deal, and you all must have been ecstatic when you made it.
We were. I remember the first time that we really saw it. Everybody was extremely excited. The condition in the non-human primates looks exactly like what's described in the human setting. So I think we've got something that is going to be highly valuable, yeah. Yeah, so, we're pretty excited.
I bet. So then, again, there's a two-week window. Is that right? That's the magic time frame here?
Yeah, the non-human primates respond very similarly to humans. So on average, I believe it was 18 days post-exposure to when they developed the severe respiratory distress indicative of the human condition. So we're really going to start focusing in on the days before that, looking at what exactly is going on and trying to figure out how the virus is turning the immune system and the body against itself.
Dr. Safranis, do you think we'll see a vaccine in our lifetime?
I think a vaccine is completely possible, and in a targeted approach, for example, looking at people who are perhaps at a high risk of exposure, it would be very beneficial. I think it could be achievable, yes.
What does this mean, that this work was achieved, accomplished right here in Montana?
Well, first of all, the opportunity for us to do this line of research in Montana is just extremely exciting to all of us here. We really love living and working in Hamilton and the state of Montana. This state actually has one of the higher incidences of disease. So, you know, I believe there's 37 cases that have been documented across the state over the last several years. So, you know, it's an appropriate place to focus this line of research. I think it will be beneficial to the population of Montana, as well as everywhere else in North and South America.
When it comes to hantavirus here in Montana, at least, geographically, are there certain hot spots, more cases in some places than others?
You know, it's difficult to say that, really. It occurs rather sporadically, and I know the guys at Montana Tech University have done some great field work all across the state, and basically everywhere that they look, if I recall their studies correctly, they're able to find the virus. So it is basically statewide.
One last question. A lot of people are now opening up their cabins, getting ready for the spring and summer. What's the best way, the safest way in terms of hantavirus to do that?
Yeah, it's important to note this is the time of the year where we do see a lot of infections. And when people are going into these buildings that haven't been occupied over the winter, it's important to follow the CDC recommendations. And they're listed very well on their website. But basically, opening up a building and letting it air out before entering it, if you notice rodent droppings or signs of rodent activity, you have to take very good care, clean with mild bleach solutions or disinfectants. Spray as much as you can down and let it sit for 10 or 20 minutes just so that the virus can be inactivated. It's important to wear gloves if you can, and certainly protect your respiratory tract, so wearing a respirator to prevent inhalation of the virus. It's actually not so difficult to prevent infection. It's just quite often people forget or don't realize the risks.
Yeah, and it sounds like a hassle to go through all these extra steps, but really in the big picture, it's not a big deal and the payoff could be very important.
No, it's not a big deal. And again, you know, one out of every three people infected with this virus essentially succumbs to the disease. So it's not something to take lightly.
All right. Dr. David Safronitz, thank you so much for joining us and congratulations on your all successful research.
Thank you very much.
For tonight's forecast, west of the Divide tonight should be mostly cloudy with lows in the 30s. Wednesday, expect mostly cloudy skies and highs in the upper 60s to mid-70s. Poor central Montana tonight, look for partly cloudy skies and lows 35 to 40 degrees. Wednesday should be mostly cloudy with a slight chance of rain and highs in the 60s. For southwest Montana tonight, expect mostly cloudy skies in the evening, becoming partly cloudy and lows 30 to 35 degrees. And Wednesday, look for increasing clouds and highs 60 to 65 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Pat Williams.
You know, let's think about this. Some of the major news items of the past, well, several years, perhaps more, have been about cataclysmic or near cataclysmic natural catastrophes. Forest fires, floods, hurricanes, landslides due to heavy rains, tornadoes, and this recent news about the possibility that almost a third of Antarctica, the continent of Antarctica, is beginning to break loose from the ice shelf. Nature is seeming to use its great forces. Not so much as a wake-up call, because nature doubtlessly doesn't know we're asleep, but we seem to be. It reminds me that 30 years ago, this coming weekend, in fact, volcanic forces ever present in our evolving landscape of this Pacific Northwest reached ultimate force and pressure, and breaking the fragile crust of the Earth's surface exploded, blowing away the crown and one whole side of Mount St. Helens in Washington State. It was 8:32 on a Sunday morning May 18th, that the youngest volcano in the Cascade Range erupted. The mountain had been actively belching gas and smoke for nearly 2 months. The activity had been receiving worldwide attention. Photographers, television, radio, journalists, scientists, and simply the curious had been gathering in the nearby towns of Vancouver and Portland to monitor and watch the until then minor eruptions with the expectations that perhaps the big one would come. They kept a kind of death watch of Mount St. Helens, reporting a wide variety of news and information. We all heard about everything from the local color of the town's citizens to the geography of the Cascade Range. Spirit Lake, with its grand 150-foot waterfall at the base of the mountain, was directly in the path of the destructive blast, which, when it came, was 500 times greater than the force of the explosion, which devastated Hiroshima, Japan. On that May morning, 3 decades ago, the blast caused the biggest landslide in recorded history, devastating 230 square miles. Searing gas at temperatures of 400 degrees Fahrenheit scorched every living thing in the immediate blast area. Ash and pumice hurtled away from the mountain at 200 miles an hour, stripping branches from trees, toppling conifers, and covering the land and forest with a pyroclastic flow that reached temperatures of 1,400 degrees. The destruction reached 15 miles beyond the volcano. Mud flows hurled rock and trees and ash toward the Kalitz River, Castle Lake, and Spirit Lake. 57 people disappeared. The once 9,677-foot-high mountain had blown away 1,300 feet of its top. The ash rose up and up miles into the morning sky, drifting toward us in Montana, drifting eastward, and eventually circling the earth, and some of its particles these decades later are still circling. The ash slowly falling as it went showered the states of Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana. I was serving in the U.S. Congress then as the congressman from Western Montana, and many of my colleagues from states in the East and the South asked me, "Pat, is Mount St. Helens in your district?" And I would say, "It is now." In 1982, we in the Congress declared 110,000 acres of the area a national volcanic monument. It was decided wisely, I think, to leave the area completely alone and simply watch nature's recovery. The natural repair and rejuvenation process moved with surprising rapidity. The wildflowers were first, the predictable firewood, lupine, Indian paintbrush. Willow and alder trees sprouted, grew, and thousands of them have now created new forests. The animals, elk, goats, deer, gopher, and as always, coyotes are back. Outside the National Monument areas, trees have been planted, and in the fertile soil and with the abundant moisture there, some of those trees are now 75-foot tall shade trees. Nature has recovered the area with life and greenery, and this isn't the first time. It is estimated that this most active of volcanic chains has had many dozens of major eruptions during the past 4,000 years, and they seem to come usually one at a time every 100 years or so. One cannot remember that Sunday morning 30 years ago, or visit that area today without recognizing that, in the end, people are simply observers of nature's fury and her extraordinary powers of recovery. This is Pat Williams. Thanks for listening.
Pat Williams is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening, and please join Editor O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.